Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Upgrade your kitchen today with Clearview Cabinetry. We offer a great selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and with cabinet accessories to match your unique style. View our selection of Clearview Cabinetry on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
It's 6:25 a.m. on March 12, 1930, in Ahmedabad in western India. Dressed only in a hand-spun loincloth, 61-year-old Mahatma Gandhi rises from a cross-legged position of meditation. He stretches his body as the pale dawn light creeps beneath the door of his room. He reaches for a wooden staff and taps it on the floor, feeling its weight. It will have to serve him well in the weeks ahead. Today, Gandhi intends to set out on a walk to a coastal village more than 240 miles away. At the end of the journey, he plans to break the law imposed on Indians by their British rulers, and he will do it in full view of the world, but he will not walk alone. Gandhi opens the door. Hundreds of well-wishers wait outside, forming a long, expectant line. Gandhi lifts a hand in greeting and begins to walk. Dozens fall in behind him, each of them committed to the long march ahead, but they all know the eyes of the world will be fixed on the small and unassuming man leading them. Over the next 23 days, Mahatma Gandhi and his followers will walk in sandals toward the coast. When they arrive, they will collect salt from the Arabian Sea. It's a simple act, but one that's illegal under British rule in India, and it's all part of a new era of nonviolent disobedience, one that began on March 12, 1930.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is March 12, 1930, Gandhi's Salt March. It's November 8, 1906, at the Colonial Office in London, 24 years before Mahatma Gandhi and his followers set out for the sea. 37-year-old Gandhi follows an official up a sweeping staircase. Light from a chandelier glints off gold leaf trim as he climbs, his briefcase knocking against his knee with each step. Gandhi wears a stiff and formal suit, but he still feels hopelessly out of place amid the grandeur of the British capital. Born and raised in India to a middle-class family, Gandhi studied law before securing employment in British-ruled South Africa. There, he saw firsthand the poor treatment of Indian-born migrant workers by the colonial authorities, and Gandhi soon put his sharp mind to work. He established a Council of Indian Migrants and published a magazine, intending both to be a voice for Indian workers. But despite his criticisms of the colonial regime, when the Boer War broke out in 1899, Gandhi moved swiftly to support the British cause in South Africa. He organized the Indian Ambulance Corps and encouraged more than 1,000 Indians to act as stretcher bearers for British troops on the battlefield. That service gave Gandhi the opportunity to meet with British officials, and now it's brought him here to London to meet with one of the most powerful men in the empire, Lord Elgin, the Secretary of State for the Colonies. Even after more than a decade as a lawyer and Indian rights activist, Gandhi's nerves plague him among such grand surroundings. He tugs at his stiff collar as the official he's been following gestures to a seat. His fingers drum on his knees while he waits, Oil paintings of government ministers staring down from the walls. Footsteps echo beneath high ceilings as clerks hurry past with stacks of paper. Then, at last, Gandhi is shown into Lord Elgin's office. After brief formalities, Gandhi gets to the point. The colonial government in South Africa has recently passed the Asiatic Registration Act. And under its terms, all Indians living in South Africa must apply for a registration card and carry this documentation with them at all times. Anyone found without faces a fine, imprisonment, even deportation back to India. But there is no requirement for non-Indians to register, and Gandhi argues that this is unfair and makes Indian migrants second-class citizens in South Africa. To Gandhi's surprise, Lord Elgin listens closely without interrupting and even nods his head at several points. Then, when Gandhi finishes, Elgin rises, thanks him for bringing this matter to his attention, and promises that the Asiatic Registration Act will be reconsidered. Encouraged by this success in London, Gandhi returns to South Africa, but he soon discovers that his victory was a hollow one. Less than a year later, the colonial government reintroduces the Registration Act, and this time Lord Elgin does not intervene. For Gandhi, this reversal is a profound betrayal, and it's not one he will let stand. He refuses to comply with the Registration Act, even if that means imprisonment. But he's not the only one angry. Gandhi rallies the Indian community, persuading them to join him in his protest, so that by the time the registration deadline arrives, only 511 out of 13,000 Indian workers have complied with the new law. Dozens are soon arrested, and as the ringleader of the resistance, Gandhi himself is given 2 months in jail. But upon his release, he encourages any Indians who've signed up to burn their registration documents, and the antagonized authorities arrest him again. He's sent back to prison for another 2 months, but as soon as his sentence is complete, he's picked up by the police for a third time. Still, repeated bouts of imprisonment don't silence Gandhi. In fact, they have the opposite effect. Word of his campaign spreads far and wide, and the protests continue for years. Eventually, Gandhi encourages Indian workers to go on strike, and the impact on the economy finally forces the colonial government into concessions. In the summer of 1914, the colonial governor in South Africa agrees to repeal the Asiatic Registration Act a second time. Yet just as Gandhi achieves this hard-won victory, a personal tragedy strikes. His older brother dies in India, leaving Gandhi little choice but to go home to support his family. But he will return a changed man, no longer an unknown lawyer, but a charismatic and successful leader. Back home, he'll be welcomed by the growing nationalist movement, and soon Gandhi will turn his attention toward the fate of Indians living not in South Africa, but in India itself. It's December 1929 in Lahore, India, 14 years after Gandhi returned to his homeland. Inside a hall packed with hundreds of people, 60-year-old Gandhi steps onto a low stage wearing a simple loincloth. A hush falls over the room as he approaches the microphone, a single sheet of paper in his hand. The air feels charged, because for months, rumors have rippled through the country that Gandhi is preparing to take a decisive step, that he's finally ready to publicly support full Indian independence. After his return from South Africa, Gandhi emerged as the most influential leader of the Indian National Congress, the country's main nationalist movement. He continued the work he had begun abroad, organizing campaigns against discriminatory and unjust laws. He fought to reduce the crushing rents charged to Indian farmers by British landowners, and he spoke out for mill workers whose wages and working conditions amounted to little more than forced labor. And as a visible, deliberate sign of solidarity with India's poorest, Gandhi abandoned the tailored suits he once wore as a lawyer and adopted the plain loincloth of a laborer. And when he traveled across the country to rally support, he insisted on riding third class, sleeping on overcrowded benches alongside ordinary Indians. His message was unmistakable. Gandhi would not ask others to endure hardships he himself would not share. Gandhi also founded a spiritual community, or ashram, opening its doors to anyone curious about his philosophy and way of life. It was during one such visit that a supporter bestowed upon him the honorific Mahatma, meaning great soul. The name stuck and spread quickly. Yet despite his lifelong advocacy for Indian rights, Mahatma Gandhi resisted the more radical voices who demanded immediate and total independence from Britain. He feared the consequences of reckless confrontation and believed in gradual reform instead. But in recent months, his thinking has shifted. He believes a new moment has arrived, and today he's ready to make his change in attitude public. Clearing his throat, Gandhi leans toward the microphone. He reminds his audience that nonviolent resistance has always defined their struggle and that peaceful protest must remain its moral core. Still, he declares that Britain has failed to respond adequately to the needs of the Indian people. So Gandhi announces that the British government must now commit to granting India the right to self-government. When he finishes speaking, the hall erupts in applause. And within weeks, the Indian National Congress adopts Gandhi's declaration as official party policy. But Gandhi knows that words alone won't change the policies of the British government. He needs to force them into action. And he soon identifies the perfect symbol to mobilize the nation, salt. In India's hot climate, salt is essential, not only for flavor, but to preserve food. But for almost 50 years, the British authorities have exerted a monopoly over it. Salt can only be collected and manufactured at official depots, and every grain is taxed. Indians cannot collect salt themselves, and to Gandhi, this injustice is obvious. He argues that preventing ordinary Indian workers from gathering salt is akin to denying them air or water. So Gandhi soon concocts a plan. He will urge Indians to break the law by collecting their own salt from the sea, and he's going to lead by example. He'll journey to the coast himself, not by train, but on his own 2 feet, knowing that his long walk will draw more attention and support. So on March 12, 1930, Gandhi sets off from his ashram with 78 followers. It's the beginning of what will become known as the Salt March. Each follower has been carefully chosen to represent a cross-section of Indian society, different castes, regions, and backgrounds. But almost immediately, it becomes clear that thousands more want to join them. Because on the first day of the march, more than 100,000 people line the route, banging drums and cymbals as the marchers pass by. That night, Gandhi then addresses a crowd of 4,000 who have gathered to hear him speak. Newsreel cameras record his words, and reporters file stories for newspapers around the world. And as the word spreads, more and more followers join the protest. After more than 3 weeks on the road, the procession of marchers stretches almost 2 miles long. And by the time Mahatma Gandhi closes in on his final destination, his protest will have grown so large that it will be impossible for the British to ignore. It's 5 a.m. on April 6, 1930, in Dandi, a village on the west coast of India, 24 days after Mahatma Gandhi and his followers set out on the Salt March. Gandhi leads his exhausted followers onto a narrow beach where the waters of the Arabian Sea lap gently against the sand. His legs are sore and his back aches, but after 240 miles, he has reached his destination. Gandhi lowers himself to his knees beside a shallow rock pool. He plunges both hands into the seawater, scooping up a clump of wet mud. Holding it aloft, he declares that this humble mixture of earth and water is enough to shake the foundations of the British Empire. He drops it into a pot of seawater that is brought to a boil, and within minutes, a thin crust of salt begins to form. This simple act of extracting a mineral from the sea is enough to see Gandhi labeled a criminal. The colonial authorities respond swiftly, arresting him and sending him to prison. But by then, news of the Salt March has already spread across India and around the world. And inspired by Gandhi's example, ordinary Indians begin collecting salt for themselves. Over the next month, more than 60,000 Indians are arrested for avoiding the salt tax. The jails soon begin to overflow, and faced with such widespread, disciplined civil disobedience, the authorities confront an impossible reality. They cannot imprison an entire nation. Eventually, Gandhi is released and invited to London for talks on India's future. Progress is slow, marked by delays and setbacks. Still, the momentum can't be stopped. And in August 1947, the British finally withdraw from the Indian subcontinent, splitting the land it ruled there into 2 independent states, India and Pakistan. But Gandhi will only experience this freedom briefly. In January 1948, he will be assassinated, the victim of an Indian extremist who rejects his calls for religious tolerance and reconciliation with the majority Muslim Pakistan. But that independent India and Pakistan exist at all is thanks in large part to Mahatma Gandhi and his long campaign of nonviolent resistance. And never did that movement capture the world's attention more powerfully than during the long salt march that began on March 12, 1930. Next on History Daily, March 13, 1996, the worst mass shooting in British history leads to the outlawing of the private ownership of most handguns. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazib. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Thrum. This episode is written and researched by Owen Paul Nichols. Edited by Scott Reeves. Managing producer Emily Burke. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.